It's Fox News host, our favorite Fox News personality. It's the one and only. It's Bill O'Reilly. Bill, are you there?
That's an insult, Jimmy. A goddamn insult.
What is an insult, Bill? What are you
describing me as a, quote, Fox News personality? I am so much more than that. I'm a commentator, a prognosticator, an unequivocator, and when I'm chatting about falafels, a chronic masturbator.
Bill, you are willing to describe yourself as a masturbator? Really?
The best there is, goddammit. The best there ever was. Although, to be clear, all the charges against me were dropped after I paid my accuser millions of dollars, so I was completely exonerated.
Bill, I'm surprised that you are the one dredging up this old news right now. That's kind of weird.
Well, Jimmy, it's Fox News' 18th anniversary.
Oh.
And I'm in a nostalgic. This milestone has inspired me.
Really?
To take a moment to quietly reflect and look back at the many times I've ejaculated into a sock while talking to a female underling on the phone.
Okay, Bill, so this is an older, wiser, and more mature Bill O'Reilly that I'm talking to right now.
Don't make me out to be some over-the-hill old-timer, Dore. I'm very much of the moment with new and exciting ideas. Like, for instance, my idea that America should hire an army of mercenary soldiers of fortune.
What? To fight ISIS in the Middle East? Yes, Bill, you've already floated that plan, and it's been roundly debunked already, okay?
Shut up, Dore. Just shut up. What? You hear me?
Yeah, I hear you.
I just told you to shut up. Shut up!
Yeah, well, Bill, I'm not shutting.
Why aren't you responding to my call for you to shut up?
Bill, Bill, when you see...
Shut up. I said shut up.
Bill, I'm telling
just
you...
shut up.
What? Stop telling me...
Okay, now I'm going to give you the last word.
Okay, all right. I appreciate you giving me the last word. What I want to say.
Shut up!
Now, Bill, stop it!
Just shut up!
Bill, you're losing.
Shut up!
Bill! Bill! Ouch. Bill, you're losing your cool air, buddy, all right? Like, Bill.
Not possible, Dore. Never going to happen.
What?
Anyway, as I was about to say before you rudely interrupted me,
what are you
I moved on from my call to send a mercenary army to stop ISIS. I've come up with a much more practical plan.
Yeah, what's that? What's your practical plan?
Bill? Hire a mercenary army to stop Beyonce.
What are you talking about, Bill? What are you talking about?
She's a threat to our national security, Jimmy.
How?
Only a trained force of highly skilled and well-paid soldiers of fortune can stop her from spreading her left-wing agenda of funky propaganda.
Bill, listen to me, buddy. I really, really, I don't think...
That's right, Jimmy. I used the term funky.
Yes, you did.
I know all the hip phrases the colored kids use.
I don't think so.
I ain't no jive turkey.
Oh, God.
Bill, right now you're being offensive on so many different levels. Do you have any idea about
yes,
that?
I know how to talk to the blacks.
No, you don't, Bill.
Like, for instance, here's a cool up-to-date urban thing I'd like to say to a homeboy.
Okay, go. What is that?
Hey, Hoggy Bear. What's the word on the street?
No. No.
Bill, I have to know exactly what... What do you mean? What do you mean by funky propaganda?
Jimmy, let me break the word propaganda down for you.
Okay.
Prop is the thing Carrot Top uses to get more laughs in 1 minute than you've gotten in your entire miserable career. Okay. And Uganda, I believe, is the African country Obama and Beyonce were born in.
That's propaganda. Bill, I'm going to have to end this. Thanks for joining us. Congratulations on 14 years at the Fox News Channel. Congratulations on
that's right. 14 years, bitches. I'm very proud. It's the longest run of any TV channel in the history of broadcasting.
You know, actually, Bill, I'm checking my notes. CNN has been around a decade and a half longer than that. NBC, CBS has been on TV since at least... I don't know, at least I'm going to go back to 1948.
Or let me explain something to you.
Okay.
Fox News has been on the air since 1996. 1996 is a much bigger number than 1948. So therefore, Fox News has been on the air longer. It's simple math.
Bill, you're just plain wrong about this, buddy.
Shut up, Pinhead. Just shut up.
Bill, I'm not.
Shut up.
I'm just telling you,
we'll
Bill.
We'll do it live.
Bill,
we'll do it live.
Bill, you're wrong about this.
Shut up.
Bill O'Reilly, ladies and gentlemen.
Children bleed, nothing is cut, it really needs.
She's got sword, man.
Rule expected to take effect later this year. It would force publicly traded companies to disclose how many times more their CEOs earn compared to their basic employees. It's just one of the regulations in the Dodd-Frank law that's expected to be finalized this year. Labor unions and liberal advocacy groups backing the provision. They say it will shame companies into lowering CEO pay, but critics say the regulation would just force companies to compile complex data to determine the median salary of all their employees, which could cost them millions. It's already cost them millions of dollars. You know, a lot of companies are trying to comply with this in advance. They're essentially trying to slut-shame companies into paying their highest workers less money.
And slut-shaming companies is not the job of the U.S. government at all. And that info already exists out there, by the way, Kennedy. They could pull up a lot of these reports, and there's plenty of people who work in the federal government who are sitting around picking their nose today at their computer who could do this on their own. That's not a good use of taxpayer dollars. Also, Kennedy, the only people that should care about this are the shareholders, how much people make at the company. Otherwise, frankly, it's none of the government's business. But if they do want to do this, I think it would be helpful to tell us the difference between benefits that you get when you work for the government and a private company, or how easy it is to get fired at a private company versus how hard it is to get fired at a government.
I mean, that would be a much more useful index. Yeah. And by the way, it doesn't require government imposition of these types of regulations, which essentially just kill business. California is considering legislation that would require companies to have the same sort of public manifesto. It's just another handwritten invitation for corporations to leave that. What I think is so interesting about it is they're not saying your CEO has to present the dollars that they're making. They're doing this. You have to present a ratio.
A ratio, yes.
And they give the example of, you know, somebody who's making $45,000 versus over $12 million. It would be a 1 to 268 ratio. That foments people being very angry. And that's something that people can tap into. They can harness it and leverage it for their own use.
Well, did you want to say something?
As being the CEO of a corporation and many other corporations, I'm the guy that stays awake. I'm the guy that was up at 2:30 last night worrying about receivables. I'm the guy who's personally guaranteeing things. I'm the guy that's out there. So I should have no way of telling people how much money I'm making. I'm keeping that company going. If it's a public company, they're being wiped out by regulatory stuff. Private companies, but it's nobody's business. If you can find me a good CEO that's going to bring my market cap, I'll pay him anything, okay? And Jack Welch had a great idea. Take the 10% on the bottom, fire them so everyone works harder. And a CEO are very hard to find. And when you get a good CEO, he's worth every dollar.
And when you're spending time, Bo, crunching all these numbers
right
for the government.
Thank you.
Yeah. When you're spending all this time crunching numbers for the government, that's less time you spend focusing
on
your business.
Absolutely.
And that's
so
not
the
great.
Government should stay the heck out of corporations, as it is with the public corporations. They put
and
their
with everything else.
Yeah.
Jedediah, I will say this very quickly, and I want you to speak to this girl. Wouldn't you say that it is the Fed's monetary policy which is creating this false bubble on Wall Street, which is enriching CEOs? Mm. And if we would have less regulation, we would have naturally more wealth in this country?
Yeah, less regulation is always a better option. And I'm just wondering what the government's, you know, what are they going to do to equalize it? They don't like this. They obviously don't like CEOs making this amount of money. They want to come in and be able to tell you what the ratio should be. Is that next? They're going to dictate how much everyone should make. They're going to look at what kind of hours they put
in. Yes, they're going to have a BMI for all corporations, not just publicly traded ones. And that, again, so take your
I gotta give this off my chest. Eat the rest.
J.P. Morgan and the U.S. settle for $13 billion. But according to journalist and author Matt Taibbi, rather than achieving justice, the cash there was really for secrecy. In his latest piece for Rolling Stone, Taibbi introduces us to Elaine Fleischman, former J.P. Morgan Chase employee who witnessed fraudulent behavior inside the bank and tried to stop it, but the government and the bank both tried to keep her story quiet. She joins me now, along with Matt Taibbi, to discuss. Thank you both for being with us today.
Thank you.
Matt, I want to read a piece here. You explain what this Chase settlement was or maybe wasn't in your piece. And you write, the average person had no way of knowing what a terrible deal the Chase settlement was for the country. The terms were even lighter than the slap-on-the-wrist formula that allowed Wall Street banks to neither admit nor deny wrongdoing, the deals that had helped spark the Occupy protests. So tell us a little bit about how bad this deal actually was and why we didn't know it, because it certainly looked like a good headline, and it was called historic.
Well, there's a lot of reasons why this was not a good deal for the American public. First of all, the number $13 billion was highly deceptive. I mean, that's the one thing they point to is we got this enormous amount of money from the bank. In fact, when you actually reduce all the accounting out of it, it's really a much smaller deal. $4 billion of that is what they call consumer relief, which the bank typically doesn't actually pay out of its own pocket. $7 billion of that settlement was tax deductible. So actually that means that you and me and Elaine, actually not Elaine because she's Canadian, but all American taxpayers actually picked up a significant portion of that check, about $2.4 billion. But the main thing is nobody went to jail, nobody was indicted, no individual had to pay a penalty, and the most important thing is the truth didn't come out. They structured this deal in a way so that it didn't have to go before a judge, there was no complaint that outlined the names and the dates and the who and the where. And it just buried all the facts of the case.
And so, Elaine, this is where you come in, because maybe things could have turned out differently. Tell us about what role you had at the bank.
I was hired there as a deal manager. Basically, I'm involved in taking these loans that were originally done by banks like Greenpoint or Countrywide that we all know about, who were making these loans with borrowers who weren't going to be able to pay them back, who couldn't afford, you know, the prices they were getting set up with. And we were buying those in order to pool them and then sell them to investors. So part of our job in that and what we're telling investors we're doing is going through these loans to make sure they're of good quality so that they will pay when they're handed over. The problem was that in that we started looking at them and realizing there were problems with these loans, but they were still being put in without any special disclosure in order to tell the investors about these problems.
And so what happened when you actually tried to flag that, when you tried to do your job and say, this is a bad deal?
Well, there was one deal in particular that was really strange. When they first came in, you could already tell that there was a problem with the pool. And then it turned out that 40% of the loans in this pool were what they call overstated income. To give an example, which Matt had in the piece, one of them was a manicurist who said she was making $117,000 per year. If you look at what a manicurist normally makes, even in New York, it's about $23,000. So we're talking about loans that were five times bigger than what this person could afford. And we go through we went through this normal process of the usual sort of email notifications and reports, and everyone thought that they would just not buy these loans. But what happened is basically this new diligence supervisor that they had hired started just yelling at the diligence managers who were saying no to buying the loans and sort of berating them and making them redo reports and just making it clear that their life was going to be miserable until these loans cleared and were purchased.
So bullying them and intimidating them into letting these deals go through.
It's funny because it's a process. The comparison I like to make here is that it's a lot like the way, you know, the way police sometimes extract false confessions. You just ask the question over and over and over and over again, and you don't let people leave until they give you the answer that they want. And that's what happened in this case. The analysts who were looking at these deals and supposed to be checking to see if these loans were bad loans or risky loans or you know, likely to default, every time they gave them the wrong answer, the bosses would yell at them and belittle them and force them to do busy work. And until the message was clear, until you give us the answer we want, we're not going to stop.
But you weren't the only one in this position, right? I mean, the question is, of course, all we ever got was this settlement. There were never any criminal charges that were filed. And you have to just, you would hope to assume that at some point during an investigation by the Justice Department, that people like yourself would be spoken to, and there would be other former employees that could have said, we saw that these were bad deals and that we tried to do something about it and we were bullied into it. You know, why did that part never come through?
Well, the difficulty with these settlements, too, is I don't even know what other employees did. So there's a Wall Street Journal article that actually quotes an employee as saying that we were blowing past our internal warnings. And I know that wasn't me. So there must be at least some other employee in there that was also saying the same sort of things I was. The other thing that was amazing is that we were actually not allowed to send emails. So the supervisor who was pushing all of these loans through not only wouldn't send emails himself, but we weren't allowed to send them to him. So you've got this process.
Because they didn't want a record, written record of what was happening.
Yeah, so it ends up looking like it was the decisions of these more junior diligence managers instead of something that was actually being pushed on them from above.
But it was being pushed on you from above.
Absolutely.
And that's, I mean, again, this is a crucial distinction. One of the sort of myths of this whole subprime mortgage crisis was that the whole thing was a big accident. You know, they use the term sometimes a thousand-year flood to describe what happened in 2008. Whereas the reality is, and now we have somebody who was there who can actually tell us, these were willful, intentional crimes where they absolutely knew exactly what they were doing. And what they were doing, it sounds complicated, but what they were really doing is they were just selling a defective product to retirees, to pensioners, to ordinary working people, to foreign hedge funds and things like that. So it was, you know, essentially mass theft. They were selling snake oil.
And those are all the people who ultimately ended up losing big money at the end. And yet the people that were selling the snake oil are still, for the most part, doing just fine and still heading the banks and running the banks.
Sitting down in a restaurant, tell the waiter just what you want. Is that the meat you wanted to eat? How would you ever know? Hash browns and bacon strips, I love the way that you lick your lips. No fooling, I can see it drooling. Feel the hunger grow. Come on, baby, eat the Ritz. Put the bite on the son of a bitch. Don't mess up, don't you hear me, no shit. Come on, baby, and eat the Ritz. Come on, baby, and eat the Ritz. Come on, honey, here's your supper. Come on, baby, fight that sucker.
We opened with Bill O'Reilly on The Jimmy Dore Show from Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles with Texas' own Mike McRae. How CEOs are being slut-shamed from Fox Business News. Matt Taibbi and Elaine Fleischman on The Long Con by Your Overlords. 20th Century Schizoid Man by Ken Crimson. Eat the Rich by Aerosmith. Eat the Rich by Motorhead. And I should warn you that eating the rich could come back on you. History has shown that eating the rich is often fattening. Speaking of class wars, we're closing up with a 1967 interview with arch-conservative William F. Buckley by arch-liberal Woody Allen, because they don't make liberals and conservatives like that anymore. You've been listening to the Interside Radio Program with me, Scooter, and I'll see y'all next week.
And now we're going to come to the question and answer period of the program. We're going to discuss some of the salient events of 1967 and to counterbalance my views, which are desperately liberal and criminal at times, is one of the most controversial and charming men on television, Mr. William F. Buckley, Jr. I see you're carrying a pen with you. Is that the significance of anything, Mr. Buckley?
How do you know it's not a mace?
A mace? You're going to have a shot of gas right in the eye, Ben. Well, I think you...
Not unless you provoke me.
I'm not going to lay a finger on you. Let me start out in a wonderfully warm and general way. Since we want to discuss 1967, I'd like to get your opinion on the year in general. I mean, did you think for the United States it was a good year or a disaster year, or how would you rate it?
Oh, somewhere in between. A little closer to disaster than to good, mm-hmm. Wouldn't you say?
For me, personally, it was a terrible year. Yes, but for the country at large...
Even though you don't live in Detroit?
Yes, but my mother scribbled Soul Brother on the side of a synagogue. On from there... I want to ask a question because there's somebody in the dock there or at the lectern.
Mr. Buckley, who would you like to see as the presidential nominee for 1968?
Well, somebody who would beat Johnson.
That could be anybody, including the Boston Strangler. Lady, what's your question?
Mr. Buckley, do you think miniskirts are in good taste?
Do I think what?
Miniskirts are in good taste.
On you, I think they are. Good legs are in good taste.
Good legs. I never would have figured you for that kind. I figured it was straight politics and that was it. You said.
What would your reactions be to a conservative president?
A conservative president. My opinion has always been, not hostile, I would like to see you or another conservative be president for a year. And I think it would cure the United States of conservatism forever.
I think the probability is that you voted for Lyndon Johnson. I didn't. And it's interesting how many people are dissatisfied with... the alternative to conservatism. You remind me a little bit of the... Evelyn Waugh said one time about Nancy Mitford that, you know, she voted for the socialists after the war in England, and having done her best to make England uninhabitable, she went to France to live. You people were complaining about Lyndon Johnson, the ones who voted for him, aren't you?
We are, but we were faced with a bleak, if not miserable, alternative.
Mr. Allen, in your terms, what does liberal mean?
Liberal? Oh. Well, you've got me on this. If a girl... if a girl will neck with me, she's liberal. If Mr. Buckley will neck with me, he's very liberal.
Mr. Buckley, do you think Robert Kennedy will ever become president of the United States?
Well, if he can induce all the Kennedys to vote for him, yes.
Yes.
Mr. Buckley, do your wife and yourself go to discotheques?
Well, we went one time, but the music, I think that's what it was too loud. No, I can't. No, I can't. Can you?
No, I can. Mr. Buckley cannot do a dance that was invented after 1860. I see a dark-suited gentleman with a question.
Mr. Buckley, do you think Charles de Gaulle is getting senile?
I think he's probably been senile. He's exhibiting what Professor Whitfogel calls the megalomania of the aging despot. Which he does very convincingly, don't you think?
Yes, I couldn't put it better myself.
I'd like to direct my question to Mr. Allen, if I may. Mr. Allen, do you think that the Israelis should give back the land that they won from the Arabs?
Should the Israelis give back the land they won? No, I don't think so. I think they should sell it back. Do you have a view of the Arab-Israeli situation, the entire Middle East situation?
Well, nothing too novel. I think eventually the Arab countries will get around to recognizing that Israel's going to be around for a while, and that when that happens, salubrious juices will...
From the Latin, salubrious, isn't it?
Nothing.
Nothing, yes.
Will happen.
matters, and you think that eventually, in time, the situation's going to work itself out?
Yeah, it'll get tranquilized in time, I suspect.
Mm-hmm. Well,
you know, sometimes, curious thing, wars do settle things. It's very unfashionable to suppose that they do. But the Israeli situation is an excellent example of where a war does situate Israeli claims in a more viable way.
Mm-hmm.
This was the third time around, this last contest, and Israel has accomplished something. So it is wrong, as I say, to suppose that wars never do accomplish anything. Sometimes, they do. It's a messy way to do it, but on the other hand, it is a way that... It is the way that it accomplishes certain things that some people want very much to accomplish. For instance, Israeli independence.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mr. Allen, do you know George Hamilton?
I don't actually know George Hamilton. I've seen him only in one picture, and I don't...
Why do you think he went to the wedding?
Why did he go to the wedding? I had heard a rumor that he was going to announce his engagement to Svetlana Stalin. Yes.
Mr. Buckley, I've heard that people have refused to be on your show. Can you tell us who they are and why?
Well, I wrote Mr. Allen 3 or 4 times. And, he does never answer, but I've always assumed it was the Christmas mail.
I would certainly be willing to come on your show and debate major issues. I think I would like to stay away from anything meaningful, however.
Well, some people don't like to exchange opinions with people who disagree with them sharply because they get sort of used to not being disagreed with. And it's sort of an unpleasant sensation to come face to face with people who analyze situations differently. William Fulbright is an example, or Wayne Morse.
These people have refused to come on your show.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Bobby Kennedy.
Bobby Kennedy. Well, is it because you pay the minimum?
I never thought of that.
We've run out of time, unhappily. And we really do have to wrap it up. I really do want to thank you because it was really nice of you to take the time for me.
Try to find a way to, but there's nothing I can say to make it stop.